to VBAC Birth Stories, a podcast where Australians share their journey to a vaginal birth after cesarean.
We are a safe haven for women to share their own VBAC journeys and through these personal experiences, educate and empower listeners.
I'm your host, Mel.
And I'm your host, Steph. And this is VBAC Birth Stories. Hi everyone and welcome to this week's episode. Mel and I are sitting down with Casey, who is a young mum living in Victoria with her husband and two children. In her first birth, Casey experienced the rare complication of a Bandel's ring and was taken in for an emergency cesarean. We speak about what it was like being a young mother in your 20s when your peers are all off doing different things and how that can have an effect on friendships. We also speak about her challenges early on with breastfeeding and allergies and what a difference finding the right support can make. In her second pregnancy, Casey speaks about the pressure she faced to book a second cesarean, even though she was perfectly suitable for a VBAC. Knowing that she was being met with resistance, Casey talks about what she did differently to ensure that she had the best chance of avoiding another cesarean. We hope that you're all well and we do hope you enjoy this episode. So today we're with Casey. Casey, thanks for joining us. We'd like to start by asking you to just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm Casey. I'm 28 years old. I'm married. I have a husband, Hayden, and we have two girls. Our oldest is Miller. She is 4, and our youngest is Ivy, and she is 2. So yeah, two beautiful little girls.
Before you fell pregnant the first time, did you anticipate having kids at that stage of your life, or had you had any preconceived ideas about falling pregnant and birth?
I always wanted kids young. Growing up, I wanted to be a lady with a baby. Like, I didn't want to be a teacher or, you know, those typical career aspirations. I just wanted to be a lady with a baby. I always knew I always knew that I wanted kids and that I wanted them young. And when my husband and I met, he was on the very same page. He wanted kids soon. And then I suppose once I found out I was pregnant, I had a small, I suppose, knowledge of pregnancy and birth and things like that, but I was quite naive. I just assumed, you know, I'm pregnant, I'll go to hospital, I'll have a natural birth, and I'll be home, you know, the next day, and it'll all just go smoothly type thing.
And did you come from a big family yourself?
No, not quite. So in my sort of immediate family growing up, it was just my mum and dad, and I had an older brother and a younger sister, but we had lots of cousins. Like, my auntie had 7 kids, and I just loved seeing like how close they all were. And yeah, I think that was what did it for me, was just seeing my extended family and how much I love them. I just wanted a big, large family of my own. Yeah.
So when you did fall pregnant, do you want to tell us a little bit about what kind of care you went for and about Miller's pregnancy?
So I live in western suburbs of Melbourne, and I didn't have private health insurance or anything like that. And we were pretty comfortable with our closest hospital, which is about 10 minutes away, which is just a public hospital. Sort of in my first appointment there, they showed us around, and all the rooms were sort of private rooms, so we didn't have to worry about sort of sharing with anyone. Like, my appointments were mainly with midwives, not the same midwife each time though. I think I saw an obstetrician maybe 3 or 4 times, and my pregnancy itself was quite uneventful. At around 34-ish weeks, I'd had a really busy day, and I hadn't felt her move, so I rang the hospital and just said, like, I'm not sure what's going on, it could be nothing, but I haven't noticed any movement. What would you recommend? And they got me to come in and popped the monitors on. And of course, as soon as I got in there, she was moving around like crazy, a little dance party or something going on in there. So they had no concerns. Yeah, it was pretty much just a really uneventful pregnancy.
And how did you feel in the lead up to the birth? Were you nervous about giving birth, or had you done any birth preparation in terms of courses or anything like that? Or were you fairly relaxed about it?
I was pretty relaxed, which is not like me. I'm quite anxious in nature. But no, I was pretty relaxed. I didn't do any courses. I took maternity leave from about 37 weeks, not knowing that I would go pretty much close to 42 weeks and have 5 weeks off work before I went on leave.
Did you go into labor spontaneously then? closer
No, I didn't. No. So my due date was actually my 24th birthday. So I had an appointment with the obstetrician and she said, you know, it's due date. Like it's time to get this baby out now. We don't really like babies to stay in much past their due date, and had a small chat about how the risk of stillbirth increases post 41 weeks and said, you know, so like, let's book in an induction and let's do a stretch and sweep today. And again, being a first time mum, I didn't really know what that involved. And looking back, there probably wasn't an adequate discussion of the risks and the benefits. It was just kind of, I'm going to do a stretch and sweep. This might help you go into labor. So let's lay on the bed and kind of get the ball rolling. She did explain there might be some bleeding and some cramping and things like that, which I did have a little bit of that afternoon, but nothing else whatsoever. So I rocked up to the hospital 40 plus 11, so 11 days overdue for my induction. They did an internal exam and my cervix was not favorable at all. So they popped a Cervidil gel in, which remained overnight, and kind of just said, cool, we'll leave this in, let it do its work, and we'll see you in the morning and you're having a baby tomorrow, get some sleep. which I didn't. I got no sleep. I don't know how they expect you to get sleep after saying something like that. Like, you know, you're going to have all this stuff going tomorrow and you're going to meet your baby. Go and get like a good 8 hours rest. It doesn't happen like that.
Doesn't.
Just prior to saying that, they had tried to put a cannula in, and I have really terrible veins, so I think it was the seventh or eighth attempt and like the fourth person to try. So I'd been a pin cushion, and yeah, I was just at this point, I was feeling really anxious. And my husband's one of those people, he can just lay down and he's asleep like mid-sentence almost. And I was kind of just like laying there, like twiddling my thumbs, like, what do I do? Like, he was asleep. And yeah, so I spent most of the night just kind of laying in my bed thinking about like what would happen and what the birth would be like and what she would be like. I kind of had no idea, and I didn't even think about what could have happened or how, like sort of what happened never actually entered into my mind, like all the events and all the ordeal the next day. But yeah, I definitely wasn't well rested, and I went into the actual birth feeling quite anxious and unprepared and just probably not in the best frame of mind. Yeah.
So did they administer Syntocin on the drip in the morning? Is that what happened after the tape?
So not quite yet. So she came in sort of bright and early, 7 a.m. She had clearly had 8 hours sleep. She was all perky and happy and was like, cool, like we'll do an internal. And my cervix was now favorable. So she said, like, I'm going to break your waters. And then that was kind of it. My waters broke and they were everywhere. And thinking back, that I was quite annoyed, and obviously didn't realize this at the time, but it wasn't even a question that was posed. It wasn't, can I break your waters? It was, I'm going to do this. So at that point, I already didn't feel like I was an active participant, or I was like, you know, an active decision maker in the process. All these things were just being decided for me and done to me, which I didn't realize at the time. I was so overwhelmed. So yeah, they popped my waters, or they broke my waters, and contractions started quite soon after. They weren't too bad. They were bearable. I could walk and talk through them, and they were sort of a few minutes in between. And about an hour or an hour and a half later, Miller turned posterior, and that was like a whole other world of pain. That was just awful. And they really ramped up at that point. So the contractions were sort of occurring and they were really painful. And when the contraction ended, the pain sort of subsided, but it didn't go away completely. It kind of just lingered there. So it felt like I was in pain or like in a contraction for majority of the time or all the time. I didn't feel like I was getting that rest between to sort of catch my breath and just steady myself. So at this point, I asked for some gas. Mind you, I went into this thinking I'm going to have this amazing drug-free birth. And, you know, like 3 hours, and I'm like, give me the gas. So I had a cannula, and they hadn't actually given me the drip at this point. The midwife was really great. She's like, you know, sit on this exercise ball. I'll massage your back. I'll teach your husband how to do it. We can try and work on some alternative ways to help reduce your pain and to help you cope. But nothing really helped at all. These contractions were just back to back, no break, and that really intense lower back pain from her being posterior. So at around 12:30 30, I think it was. So maybe 4 hours after they broke my waters. That was it for me. I just felt so tired and so defeated. I asked for an epidural and they said, yep, like we can organize that for you. You just need to hop on the bed. I need to do an internal exam first because we need to make sure that, you know, you're not fully dilated. It might be too late. But then even again, it wasn't, can you please hop on the bed and can I please do an exam? It was just more of like an order, hop on the bed. I need to do this kind of thing. So they did that and I was only 2 centimeters at the time. After hearing that, I just felt even more defeated. Like I still have such a long way to go. So they gave me the epidural. I hopped onto the bed and I think I had a nap. I think I sort of dozed on and off. I wasn't in any pain whatsoever. And they came back at about 3 o'clock and a lovely midwife came in and just sort of asked how I was going, if she could support me in any way, and asked if she could do an internal exam just to see how I was traveling. And I was fully dilated at this point.
Oh, wow. So
I'd gone from 2 centimeters to fully dilated in about 2.5, 3 hours. But at this point, I obviously still couldn't feel any contractions. So the obstetrician came in and was like, cool, we're going to get you to push now. And I was like, awesome. Like, what do? I can't feel anything. You know, everything that I've read has told me that my body will just know what to do and my body will just, you know, I need to listen to it. And when it comes to the right time, my body will do the work and it'll, like, all these systems and hormones all, you know, working together and the baby, like the contractions will deliver the baby. And she's like, oh, you just need to sit up, we'll raise the head of your bed and you just need to push. And I was like, okay, like I can try. So I still couldn't feel contractions at this point. And so they were watching on the monitor. And when the contraction would come, she was like, all right, like you need to push. And so I would push and nothing kind of happened. And the next contraction came and she's like, all right, so you need to push and nothing happened. And she's like, oh, you're not pushing very well. And I was like, oh, like, okay. All right, like how do you take feedback like that? And I think that's something that made me really angry. Like healthcare providers don't realize how much of an impact their words can actually have. You're already so vulnerable and, you know, I was exhausted and I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel listened to. I didn't feel like an active participant. And then to hear words like, oh, you don't know what you're doing or you're not pushing properly, like those words can be really awful and they can stick with you for a really long time. So yeah, that was really disheartening. And we kind of did this back and forth. They came and fiddled with the Syntocin and they put it up and down and up and down. I think they maybe changed it 4 times over the next sort of 3 hours. And then it came to around about 7:30 and the obstetrician had come in and said, all right, you know, we're going to get you on the birthing stool. Things aren't moving along as quick as we'd like. So my husband and the nurse sort of got me off the bed and I shuffled my feet over to this birthing stool and my husband had to kind of support me because I obviously couldn't really feel very much. And something changed then, and I don't know what it was. Obviously contractions, they feel kind of like a productive pain, like, you know, they're doing something, whereas I felt a different pain. And I don't know if it was my mum instincts, but I'm just like, you know, something is not right. This doesn't feel right. I don't feel comfortable. Just something is not right. And in that moment, I wasn't listened to. I was kind of shut down and the obstetrician was just like, you know, you need to just give it time. You're being impatient. Just give us a little bit more time. Because at this point I could feel the contractions starting to come back now. Each time a contraction would come back, I was like, no, like it doesn't feel the same as before. Like something doesn't feel right. I don't feel comfortable. And my concerns were dismissed again. And I was so thankful my husband the next time, he probably not as polite as this, just told the obstetrician that she needs to pull her head in and start listening. Like I'm not comfortable. I'm in charge of my body essentially at the end of the day. And my concerns are valid and they need it to be listened to. So they got me back on the bed again, but she kind of persisted with getting me to keep pushing. So they called a few more midwives, another obstetrician in, and they watched me push. And this next contraction, when I pushed, they could see Miller's head come down. But the second sort of I stopped pushing, she was pulled all the way back up again. So they were quite unsure what to do. They decided it would probably be best to go to theatre to do forceps or vacuum. And then in case anything happened, we were then in theatre should we need a C-section. And I don't really remember what happened next. I think I was there, but I wasn't present. So I was just like, whatever, like every other decision has been made for me. If that's what you think, then let's just do it. Like I'm so over it at this point. So they wheeled me down to theatre. And I remember laying in the hallway for what seemed like hours, and all these people were walking past and checking my vitals and lifting up my blanket. I'm assuming to make sure that I wasn't bleeding or anything like that. But like people that I'd never even met were like calling past and looking at all these things and doing all these things. So yeah, I felt like my dignity was kind of not a thing at this point in time. And I was wheeled into theatre where I met our amazing anaesthetist. I'm so grateful for this man, even to this day. He had one of those calming presences about him. Like we met him and he introduced himself and he was really good with my husband. He talked my husband through everything and just said like he was there to help us and to serve us. And if we had any questions, like he was our go-to man. So I was in theatre. He sort of did the ice cube test just to see how numb I was. And at this point, I was numb up to about my jaw. I couldn't feel anything below that. And I just remember feeling really spaced out. Like I was looking around the room and I could see things, but I couldn't see them clearly. Like it's all really dazed. And then I met our new obstetrician and she was just, oh, if I could give her a hug, I would have given her a hug. She was just so beautiful. She came in and said, you know, you've done such an amazing job to get this far. We just want to look after you and your baby. We do have some concerns, and walked us through sort of all of that and just said, like, we're in theatre at the moment. If it's okay with you, I would like to have a look at some contractions, see what your body does. I'd like to ideally aim for a vaginal birth for you and your baby because it is what is best. But if anything changes or I have any concerns, I'll openly discuss that with you and your husband and we can make a decision together from there. Which was kind of the first time I ever felt like I'd been included in my birth. So she watched a few contractions and said that she would like to try forceps or vacuum, but then saw Miller's head coming down and being sucked back up again. So she watched a few more and then pulled my husband aside and spoke with me as well and just said using forceps or vacuum at this point would do a lot of damage and would potentially or really be physically ripping Miller out, and that's not what she would recommend at all, and that a C-section would be the best call. So we consented to that. And I remember they always were calling it an emergency C-section, but looking now, like, it wasn't really an emergency C-section, like in terms of what you think an emergency C-section is. It was kind of, we had no other option, but it wasn't like a true emergency, if that makes sense. So yeah, our anaesthetist was just talking us through what was happening. They were putting up the curtain and, you know, the obstetrician's going to make an incision here and you might hear this or smell this. He was really good at keeping us calm. He asked for our phone so he could take some videos and some photos. And I was kind of still just laying there like dazed and foggy. I could hear people talking, but I wasn't really, again, present. And then he said, all right, like, you know, I remember him saying, be ready or get ready. Like Miller's going to be coming out any second now. And then I heard her cry and my gosh, the fog, it just lifted. Like everything was so clear and I still get emotional, like playing it back now. But yeah, so they pulled her out and I could hear her cry. My husband was crying and the anaesthetist was like so happy for us. He was like taking all these videos and photos and they held her up over the curtain for us to have a look at. And she had her hand sort of out. So we got to hold her hand and there's an amazing photo that I still cry. I still cry at when I look at it today. So she was delivered. Sorry.
Okay. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, compose myself. Yeah. So they took her over to the table. I remember the obstetrician saying, you know, she's a beautiful color and she has all this amazing vernix on her and she's a great size. So they took her over to have her checked out. Towards the end, I think they had some concerns. Her heart rate was increasing, but it was never coming back down. It would sort of slowly taper down, but then it would skyrocket again and it would never sort of stay low. Or
like tachycardia?
Yeah.
And the higher end, so not the lower heart rate.
Yeah, tachycardia, yeah. But it sort of would never fully return to sort of a normal heart rate before it would skyrocket again. Mm-hmm. So they checked her out and they said she was fine. And I remember the anaesthetist, he was like, all right, like get the blanket off her, get the hospital gown off. Mum, like these two are going to have skin to skin, everything else can wait. So he was a really big advocate for getting me and Miller together and skin on skin and all of that, which I really appreciated at the time. And now looking back, the skin to skin unfortunately didn't last very long. Every time I sort of turned my head, I would vomit and it was quite like awful and aggressive, and it probably wasn't safe for me to be holding her while vomiting. And my husband took Miller back to our room, and I joined them maybe an hour and a half later. But I'll never forget how sort of isolating that theater room is. They've sort of stitched you up and you're kind of laying there, and you've been laid there and everyone's seen everything, and they're all kind of going about their business and cleaning up. And I was just watching all these people, and I was so cold. I could not stop shaking. Like, it was violent shaking. And yeah, I just felt so lonely and so isolated. Like, I had a husband and a baby, but they were gone and everyone was kind of just doing their own thing. Yeah, I'll never forget how lonely and awful and isolating that experience was at the end. But shortly after that, the obstetrician who delivered Miller came back in and said that she wanted to have a chat and that she saw something pretty rare and interesting, and she wanted to have a discussion with me and what it meant about future pregnancies and things like that. So she sort of wheeled her little laptop over and explained that it didn't present on the outside, so they believe it had just started. But once they had made the incision, they could see that I had a bandel ring. So where the upper and lower segment join, it becomes really thick. And the lower section was really, really thin at the time. And when she made the incision, that bandel ring was actually above Miller's shoulders around her neck. So each time she was being pushed through a contraction, she would obviously come down, but then that ring would pull her back up. And she was amazing. She said, like, you know, it's not your fault. It's nothing you've done. Sometimes these things happen. She said that there's not really that much research into why they happen, because they are quite rare and you can't really predict and study these things. She just said, like, don't take this as, you know, anything you've done wrong. You haven't failed. You've done an amazing job. So she was really great at, I suppose, comforting me in those moments after, where I thought, because those thoughts had already started to creep in, like, oh, like, what's wrong with my body? Is my body defective? You know, all these awful things that you think of. So she gave me a little bit of information there, but then said, like, you know, you've obviously had a huge day. I'll come back and we can have a chat in the morning once you've had some sleep and you're in a sort of a better place of mind. We'll have a chat about it all again, and you can ask as many questions as you like, and we can talk about what it might mean for future pregnancies and births and things like that. And I'm so thankful for her and the approach that she took.
You know, in terms of the Bandel's ring, you were saying there, so it wasn't visible on the outside. And the only clue that it was there was what was happening with Miller being pushed down and then pulled back upwards. Yeah.
So she said she thought she had suspected, but normally they present on the outside. Like, if you look in photos, and there's not many to go by, there's a very sort of distinct ring or presentation in photos. So she did wonder if maybe towards the end, the obstetrician sort of fiddling with the syntocin and the induction and all of this, my body quite not being ready. She wondered if it had started to form, and just when they had made the incision, that's when it had become, I suppose, noticeable, or that's when they had identified it.
What did she indicate about future pregnancies?
So she was fully supportive of a VBAC. When she came in the next morning, she said from the information that she knew of, sometimes sort of inductions or long labors can be sort of a contributing factor, but did sort of note that there isn't that much research, and said that provided I was comfortable with it, she would foresee no issues with me attempting a vaginal birth in future, and actually encouraged and supported, and said, you know, if you come back for your next pregnancy, I would happily support you to attempt a vaginal birth.
So what was postpartum like for you?
I really struggled with breastfeeding, and I think that was just a lack of support. I sort of left the hospital already with, like, cracked nipples, and not to criticize, but sort of some of the midwives there had said, oh, comments like, you know, she's feeding again already, or and had talked about, like, spacing out feeds and things like that. Whereas I suppose now, having successfully breastfed my second one, I know that their advice didn't set me up for a successful breastfeeding journey, which is really disappointing, because as healthcare providers, that's sort of their main job, is to provide me the support and the information that I need to do these things successfully. So I did feel pretty let down, but Miller also did have allergies. So she had cow's milk protein allergy. So the first sort of few weeks postpartum for us were just awful, with crying and eczema and allergies. And we ended up going to just our local GP, which in hindsight was a terrible decision. He, not to be rude or disrespectful, but he just had no breastfeeding knowledge. He's like, oh, like, you know, it's your milk. Your milk is not good for her. And again, that for me just comes back to the language that you choose as a healthcare provider. Like, of course my milk is good for her. It is amazing. It is specifically designed for my baby. There is just some things that we needed to tweak or change in order for it to be better suited to her. So yeah, I felt really awful after that appointment. And I was like, oh, like, this is my fault. Like, I'm doing this to her. Like, all this screaming and these awful nappies and these rashes and reactions, this is my fault. So he said, you know, we need to get you onto formula. The reactions did ease, but they didn't go away completely after sort of a few visits. He was kind of like, you know, this is, I think it's just as good as we're going to get. We just need to power through. Here's some reflux medication and here's this medication. We're just going to have to power through. I still wanted to keep breastfeeding though, but we only made it to about, I think, 3 months. And she'd still barely gained any weight at this point. And she was just miserable. Like, she just cried all the time and she was in pain all the time and her skin was awful. So I remember when I gave her like her first full feed of formula, she like smiled and she laughed and she was so happy. And I was like, who is this baby? Like, this isn't my baby. It was probably like the first time she'd had like a full belly in I don't know how long. I think the whole mixed feeding between formula and breastfeeding had mixed this up and she wasn't actually getting as much milk that she had needed. So she did end up being fully formula fed, but we did have sort of ongoing allergy issues. I think we saw maybe 6 or 7 GPs and didn't have all of her allergies sort of properly diagnosed and a proper treatment plan in place until 18 months of age. So it took us a long while to find our GP that we have now, who we are never letting go of. We found him and anywhere he goes, we will go. But our breastfeeding journey was cut short and it was something that I mourned and I grieved. I had all these ideas that I would feed until she was ready to wean. But again, I think that lack of support and lack of knowledge, it just didn't really set me up for a successful breastfeeding journey, because you obviously can successfully breastfeed even with allergies.
Do you think that an alternative would have been maybe to remove dairy from your diet? Was that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that wasn't suggested by the GP at all?
No, not at all. And it didn't click at the time. But when he said, you know, go on to this formula, you know, Nan Comfort and do these medication, I didn't even look at the ingredients like on the tin. Like, Nan Comfort is derived from cow's milk protein. I think it was just that there is less cow's milk protein in that than what I was consuming, which is why the reactions weren't as severe, but they were still there. But yeah, knowing what I sort of came to learn about allergies going into my second pregnancy, I was fully prepared and educated to breastfeed through allergies, trial elimination diets, and all that kind of stuff. It was just, yeah, it was really hard. And then add on top of that, me sort of feeling disappointed with how my birth went. And although the obstetrician had said it, you know, it's not your fault, there's nothing that you could have done, there was still some of this residual, like, what's wrong with my body? What did I do wrong type of stuff, which is my own sort of issue. That was something that I needed to sit with and work through and process. But you sort of add all that mental load on top of the allergies and then the physical load of healing from a C-section. It was a really intense couple of weeks. My husband was amazing. He was very supportive. Not just sort of supportive in the sense of doing things, but would continually ask, like, are you going okay? Do you need help? Do you need support? Is there someone I can call? So I felt really lucky to have all of that support around me.
How did you feel that you bonded with her? And did you think that was impacted by the birth at all?
I feel like we bonded amazingly. I don't think the birth itself had any impact on that at all. We spent a lot of time sort of as a family just laying on the couch, lots of skin to skin, engaging in safe bed sharing, things like that. So I feel quite lucky that I bonded with her so quickly and so well, and that I didn't experience any sort of postpartum anxiety or depression. So I feel really fortunate in that sense. Absolutely.
Sounds like you were also really well supported.
Perhaps. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And even I had like an online dewing group. So mums who were sort of all due around the same time, I feel was really valuable.
Being in your 20s, did you have other women who were around the same age as you giving birth at the same time in your friendship groups, or what was that like?
That was probably my biggest challenge. So I was the first in my, I suppose, high school group of friends to have a baby. And even now, none of them have a child. So that was a big transition, I suppose, for me, and a big learning curve. Obviously, very different priorities and things like that. All of those things change. I can't sort of just come out and go for a drive to the city to go to a bar at 11 o'clock at night. Very dependent little human being that needs me to survive. So that was really challenging. I sort of felt like I lost myself in a way, because that was a big part of who I was, and that group of friends was a big part of who I was, but I just didn't realize that there was this whole other person that I was going to be, or that I was transitioning to, that was probably equally or more important. Yeah, and just sort of that transition between sort of independent woman going into motherhood, like that big transition, and losing friends or friendships changing. Mm-hmm. That's something that isn't actually really discussed at all, and it's not something that I expected. And even now it's something that I reflect on. Like, I obviously don't catch up with them as much as they all catch up with each other now having two children. But yeah, it definitely was a struggle not having anyone my age in real life that I can go to sort of discuss these things. It was sort of just limited to my online little mum community.
I think it's interesting because, you know, being isolated up at night with the newborn and all of that, yeah, that's something that sort of occurs whether you're 24 or 34 as well. Yeah. So those friendships that you're forming with other mothers, regardless of their age, you know, you're sort of connected in this way by this very common universal experience that's
united in motherhood.
Yeah.
It. And that's why I was so grateful. So our local community do like a mother's group. And I said to my husband, I was like, I am not going. Like, they will be the perfect mums, and I'm going to be like this young mum, and I'm going to be judged, and I'm not going to fit in, and I'm going to hate it. And he said, he's like, why don't you just go to one? And if it's not for you, then absolutely. Like, you don't have to go again. This is another support network that you have to lean on. And this can be sort of not to replace my high school friendship group. They obviously serve very different purposes, but this can just be another group of friends. So I did go, and I actually loved it, and it wasn't anything like I expected. And like, I was the youngest, but like, one of my closest mum friends is like in her early 40s, like, and we get along amazing. My best friend now I found through that group. So that was just another invaluable, like, tool. I can't believe I was contemplating not going. That just would have been one of the biggest mistakes that I could have made.
When you did fall pregnant with Ivy, what sort of headspace were you in? Were you excited? Were you feeling prepared? Did you know what kind of birth you would like this time around?
I was actually so surprised. My husband was like, oh, you know, maybe we should start like thinking about having another one. And so we sort of stopped contraception, and we were very lucky to fall pregnant again the first month. And I know how lucky we are, and that's not something that I'll ever take for granted. But I was very surprised, and I knew deep down from the very beginning that I wanted a VBAC, and it was not a non-negotiable. Obviously, if a C-section was needed, then absolutely, I'm all for them. I know they have their place, but provided nothing required that, I wanted a VBAC, and I wanted it more than anything. Absolutely.
Did you go back to the same hospital? Yeah. Did you contact the same obstetrician by any chance?
So I didn't end up seeing an obstetrician till later in the pregnancy. My first appointment was with a midwife, and she was just amazing. She was one of those people, like, I could be best friends with her outside of the hospital. So she asked my thoughts on what kind of birth I wanted. And I said that I was really hoping that I could attempt a VBAC. And she said, no, like, you don't say attempt a VBAC, like, you are going to have one. You can do this. We will support you. I will support you and advocate for you as best as I can. We are going to get this done. And it was like a breath of fresh air. Like, I wasn't expecting to feel that supported in my first appointment. It did come with a little disclaimer that the hospital policy was for all the obstetricians at their monthly meeting to discuss my suitability. But it was kind of like a, don't worry about it, I'll help you tackle that if that presents any issues sort of further down the track. And I sort of was on like cloud nine. Like, I was just, it, I don't know if it was naive, but I was just going through my pregnancy like, yep, I'm going to have a VBAC. Like, this is what's going to happen. I know what I'm in for this time. I'm going to research. I'm going to arm myself with as much knowledge as I can. I will be making fully informed choices this time, even if the information isn't coming from those who should be providing it to me. I'm going to go in knowing I've done as much as I possibly can to have a successful VBAC. So I saw sort of midwives for majority of my care until I had an obstetrician maybe around the 26-week mark with the first obstetrician from Miller's Birth. And I was feeling great at this point. And then I sort of walked into the appointment. And when I saw her, I sort of felt those feelings creeping back in. Like, I knew I was going to have a fight on my hands. And those feelings of just not feeling like I was an active participant, they sort of started creeping in. And then my anxiety had started to creep in. And we went through sort of the standard checks and, you know, they do the fundal height and stuff like that. And then she said, you know, so what are you thinking about the birth? We can book in a C-section now if you like. And I was just like, no, like that won't be happening. She's like, oh, we don't really normally, you know, recommend or support VBACs. And I just said that I'd received a lot of support from other care providers within the hospital and that I felt comfortable that I'd educated myself on the risks of both options. And I still felt that a VBAC presented less risk for me and the baby. And she said, no, we really like to do a C-section at 38 weeks. We can be flexible on the date, and sort of went on this little tangent. And very unlike me, I just stopped her and I said, look, that's not happening. I've decided that I'd like a VBAC and that's what I'm going to attempt. And if I had to have a C-section, it wouldn't be happening until 40 weeks or sort of there anyway, because if there's no need, like, you know, so much development and maturing happens in those last few weeks of pregnancy, that wasn't something that I was willing to forego. So if I did need a C-section for some reason, or it was my only option, it wouldn't be happening till much closer to my due date. There was still some resistance there, and I wasn't in the mood for a fight. I wasn't coming to this appointment prepared for a fight. So I just said, let's table this. We can discuss this further down the track. We still have such a long time to go.
Interesting that was just her default position.
Yes. And having spoken to other women who have birthed at the same hospital, the stories are similar, just about how it's sort of not even a conversation. There are no other options. It's just safe, I suppose, for her. Yeah, which is really annoying, because that's not what is in the best interests of women and their babies. And that's not an opinion. There is science and research and statistics and facts to support that. So It really grinds my gears. It really makes me angry when I think about it, because not everyone knows that they have to do all this research. So many people go to these appointments blindly and place so much trust in these healthcare professionals that are supposed to have your best interests at heart, but they don't really. And yeah, it's a big letdown. It's a really big letdown.
Yeah.
With regards to birth preparation, did you do anything in this VBAC pregnancy that you didn't do in your first pregnancy?
I don't know if you could call it. So I did hypnobirthing, not sort of an actual class, but I did lots of reading and research, and I downloaded lots of tracks and I listened to lots of stuff on YouTube, and I reluctantly didn't purchase it. And if I could go back in time, I would purchase like the actual package and go through the course and things like that. And I just made sure I was really physically active. I think that was probably helped by the fact that I had a toddler who hadn't quite turned two yet. So it's not like you can lay around on the couch all day. I was walking sort of 5 or 6 K each day, and I was watching, like, you know, not watching what I ate. I still sometimes indulged in like a whole block of chocolate a night, but I just sort of took better care of myself because I was willing to do anything to give myself a leg up to achieve this feedback, knowing that I was going to have a fight on my hands.
And had you given much thought in terms of things like induction? Had you given that any thought as to the paths and options you would go down with this feedback?
I did not want an induction again. I would have preferred to have an elective cesarean over an induction. Just that experience was not something that I would want to go through again. And to go through all of that pain and all of the drips and the fiddling and all the exams and stuff, I would much rather just cut out all that at this point in time in my mind frame. I was thinking I would much rather just cut out all of that middle stuff that makes me stressed and anxious and probably puts risk to Ivy, and I would just have a calm, elective C-section where I can have a maternal assisted one. I can, you know, and I can have a say in things that happen. So sort of once I got towards the end or nearing the end of my pregnancy, I just said, it'll either be I go into spontaneous labor and I deliver this baby vaginally, or I have an elective cesarean. They are the only two options that I will consider. I did not want an induction again at all. Yeah.
Were you worried at all, Casey, about uterine rupture?
I was so worried.
I was going to say, yeah, did any of that worry link in with the fact that you'd had this Bandel's ring? Did you have any thoughts that this could happen again, or had you done any research into that or spoken to the obstetrician again?
I did some research and I was really frustrated at how little research there was available on Bandel's ring. I think there was maybe when I was looking, there's a little bit more now because I've had a look recently, but when I was looking, there was maybe 5 or 6 research articles and some as old as like 1890.
I saw that too. So, yeah.
They're not exactly a reliable, I suppose, source of information.
And I don't know if that's because it just wasn't happening, or they were, or medical providers weren't picking up when there was a Bandel's ring in labor.
And so that was something that the obstetrician mentioned. She said it's not something that sort of you can predict will happen. It's not like we can monitor a pregnancy and study it for a Bandel's ring. It's something that sort of happens at the last minute with sort of no warning. But everything that I did find sort of said that just because you have one doesn't mean that you're going to have another, and there's sort of no way to predict this. So in my mind, it was still there and I acknowledged that it was a possibility, but it wasn't something that I tried to let factor into my decision making just because they were so rare. But I definitely did think about uterine rupture quite a lot, and not that I'm sort of dramatic or anything like that, but I just kept thinking, like, what if the worst case scenario happens and it's because I've chosen to have a VBAC and for some reason something happens and my baby dies? Like, that's on me and I have to live with that decision. And I know, like, one of my family members was like, oh, you know, like, that's a little bit dramatic and blah, blah, blah. And in a way it is, but it's also really terrifying to have such a big responsibility solely on your shoulders. And it's not like someone else can make the decision for you. So I definitely did think about uterine rupture, but when I sort of found myself getting carried away, I tried to just go back to what do the statistics and what does the research tell me? What does science say? What are the actual risks? Because I can think about it as much as I like, but that doesn't change the risk of it happening to me. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Did you want to take us to as you fell pregnant the second time and, yeah, the way that pregnancy went and the differences in this pregnancy compared to your first?
So they were quite similar, actually. So Ivy's was also pretty uneventful. I had a day where I hadn't felt her move at all, so I did go in for monitoring, but just like her sister, as soon as I got in there and they put the monitors on, she was, you know, they were really happy with the activity and all of that stuff. They did ask to have an ultrasound done just to be on the safe side because it had been a little while since I had one, which I'm always a little bit nervous about because I find a lot of relief in an ultrasound, but I'm also terrified that it will give them not ammunition, but just, you know, something to warrant intervention or something to warrant me doubting myself or my ability. So we went for an ultrasound and they said, oh, you know, like she's measuring quite large. I think she was 96th or 98th percentile. And that statistic seemed to take up most of the discussion in all of our appointments moving forward, which is quite frustrating because there always will be a 98th percentile baby. That's just the way percentiles work. There are always going to be big babies and there are always going to be little babies. And just because my baby is big, that doesn't mean that I can't birth her. Like, women birth big babies every day. So I was a little frustrated that that was sort of used to edge me towards induction or cesarean. I had an appointment at around 39 weeks with the obstetrician, and I'm not quite sure what was different about me at this appointment, but I just went in, I think expecting a fight, and I just felt really defeated. And the obstetrician again was sort of trying to push induction, which I made it very clear that I didn't want, but the conversation sort of still revolved around that. And at this point, not that I didn't have any fight left for me, I just couldn't be bothered anymore. So I think more just to appease them, I was like, fine, schedule a C-section date for like 42 weeks. Like, at the absolute end of this, if it comes down to it, I'm refusing an induction. So let's just give them something to stop them nagging me. We'll book a C-section in for as late as they'll allow me. And I just have to like pray and cross everything that I go naturally in the meantime. So we booked it in, and it was kind of the first discussion I ever really remember, which went into the risks. They sort of spoke about the risks of the baby potentially being cut and things like that. And I don't ever remember that conversation of the risks of a cesarean with my first. And I left that appointment and I rang my husband and I was like, oh, like we have a C-section booked for this date. And he was like, what? Like, what the hell? Like, what has happened? What have they said? What's changed? Has something gone wrong? And I just said, like, I can't deal with this pressure and this constant conversation around have an induction. You know, if you leave your pregnancy past 41 weeks, the stillbirth rate increases, which yes, it does, but the increase isn't as big as they made it out to be. So I kind of just carried on. I had Miller to keep me really busy and my mother's group. My due date came. I had no signs of labor whatsoever. And with how long Miller's went over or how far it went over, I assumed that I would still be pregnant for quite a while longer. I was 40 weeks and 3 days and I woke up to my bloody show. Which was exciting. I've never been so excited to see something that gross in my entire life. but I was also trying not to get my hopes up. Like I had lost plug a little bit before, but I know that that regenerates. So I was trying not to get my hopes up. And I was talking to, I had an online mother's group. I did it again with Ivy's pregnancy. And I messaged one of the mums that I'd become really close with, and she was really excited for me. She's like, you know, this is it. Like, you can do this. This is, it's going to happen for you. You know, you've educated yourself and you've done all this. This is it. I can feel it. It's going to happen for you today. And I just said to her, I'm like, you're just being ridiculous. Like, stop getting my hopes up. So this was sort of 7:30 in the morning and I had such a big day planned. My oldest had her best friend's birthday party at a park. So I was packing our bags to go to that in the afternoon. I had some shopping to do in the morning. So I kind of just went about my day. I ended up driving stupidly to a shopping center that's about 45 minutes away to get some things for Miller's birthday, which was coming up. And at about 10:30, I was like, oh, like that feels a bit like tight and uncomfortable. Oh, it's nothing. Like it's probably just a Braxton Hicks. And I tried to push it away back into the far depths of my mind, not trying to get my hopes up. And then maybe 3 minutes later, I felt another one. And I was like, oh, like this is weird. Like this doesn't happen to me. This isn't how I saw things going down. And I had my sister with me at the time and she sort of started to notice that I was sort of timing things and their contractions were coming regularly. They were about every 2.5 minutes, but they were lasting about 45 to 50 seconds. And this was in like a packed shopping center. I had a screaming child in the trolley that just wanted the toy on the shelf. And I really wasn't composed and calm at this point. And then all of a sudden they changed and they were about 2 minutes apart and lasting for a minute at a time. And I was still at this shopping center.
Wow.
45 minutes away from home.
Did you feel like you needed to be vocal or was like, how are you coping?
I was just holding my breath because I was so aware of how many people were around me. And like Miller was there and Miller was watching and she was having a meltdown, which is totally fine. Like she's a toddler. These are expected, you know, little people, big emotions. I'm all for that. But I was like, I can't like deal with these contractions the way I feel like I need to deal with them with a screaming toddler and a busy shopping center on a Saturday morning. So I was so thankful I had my sister with me. I was like, Nikki, like, you know, I think we need to go. I think I'm having contractions. And she was like, oh my God, like you're going to have this baby in my car. And then she was like, oh my car, like you're going to get stuff everywhere. And she was full freaking out. And I was like, I cannot deal with your freak out and a toddler having a meltdown. Well, I'm 45 minutes away from home. I haven't even packed my bags or the baby's bag, like, because it was so unexpected. So, yeah, I was like, can we just grab our things and we'll just get in the car and you can drive me home and I'll sort it out from there. And my husband was at work. So he's a shift worker. He was at work and he doesn't always have his phone on him. He does heavy machinery. So I was like, oh, do I get him to come home or is this going to die down? And then on the drive home, they really started ramping up. Like I couldn't sit still in the seat and I couldn't get comfortable. And they were sort of lasting for a minute, maybe a little more than a minute at this point. And I was really starting to freak out now because I was like, I'm just not prepared. Like I was stupid enough to think that this wasn't going to happen. And now it's happening and I'm so unprepared. Like, what have I done to myself? So yeah, we got home and I asked my sister to stay. I was like, you know, can you just look after Miller just while I get some things organized? I'm just not in the right headspace. I need 10 or 15 minutes just to gather myself. I really don't want Miller to be affected or pick up on how stressed I am. So she stayed and they weren't dying down at all. So I rang my husband and I was like, you know, I think you might need to come home. I think I'm in labor. They're lasting about a minute and they're a minute and a half apart at this point. And I don't really know what I'm doing. So maybe you should come home just in case. So he flew home. Sorry, flew. He drove really fast home. And at this point, I couldn't talk through the contractions. I kind of was leaning over the bathroom bench trying to straighten my hair because I looked like a mess. I looked like Hagrid from Harry Potter with fluffy hair everywhere. I was just so unprepared. And I was like, I'm not going to have a VBAC looking like this. Like
Hagrid.
That's literally, I looked like such a mess. So I'm like leaning over this bathroom bench, like swaying my hips through this contraction. And then as soon as they end, I'm like straightening my hair and throwing clothes and underwear and stuff into a suitcase.
Did you really straighten your hair?
Yeah, I did. It's my natural hair. So I was like, it's just so out of control. And I wanted it just out of the way so that when I was all hot and sweaty in labor, I just didn't have to worry about it bothering me.
Oh, wow.
Very faint when I look back now that I'm like, why? Why was that your priority?
My hair straightener was a big priority in those days as well. I wonder if I would have done the same thing. I would probably still do the same thing now, actually, to be fair.
Was it a GHD, Steph?
Yeah, GHD.
GHD.
No, I'm impressed that you did that, though, like that you had the physical ability to do that while in labor. Oh, like.
It was such a dodgy job, though, because I had like 1 minute between contractions. So I was just like clamping and straightening whatever I could get just so I looked like presentable. So, yeah, my husband gets home and he walks in the door and he's like, hi, like, how are you feeling? And he saw me leaning over the bench and like breathing. And he was like, oh shit. Like, I didn't realize this was what I was walking into. Like, and I was like, just pack your bag. I haven't done anything. Pack your bag. Like, pack Miller's bag. Nikki's going to watch.
Yeah. So who was going to watch your daughter?
Yeah. My sister. Yeah. So I'm really lucky. My sister's so supportive and she would do anything for Miller. So she had this fun afternoon planned. And I had always planned, like, I'm going to stay at home until I can't handle the contractions anymore. So if I have to labor at home for 8 hours, then I'll labor at home for 8 hours. So my contractions started at 10:30 and my husband got home around 12:30. And I was like, I can't handle this as well as I thought I could. Like, we just need to go to the hospital. I just want drugs. Like, if this is how much it hurts, like, I don't want to do this anymore. We packed everything in the car. I said goodbye to Miller, which was so sad. And I cried and I still cry like thinking about it because it's like the last time I'm going to see her and she's going to be my only baby. At that point, got into a good headspace. I felt like I had so far done things on my own terms and I was confident that because my body had started labor spontaneously, that I could do it. So I put my hypnobirthing in my headphones and my husband was driving us to the hospital and I thought I would ring ahead just to let them know that I was coming in. So I rang and on the other end of the phone was the midwife from my first appointment who was so supportive and was like going to do whatever she could to do to help me get a VBAC. So I felt really at ease when she answered the phone and I couldn't sort of talk through my contractions at this point. So I said to her, like, you know, I don't know if it's the real deal, but I think I'm in labor. And I was like, hold on, you know, I'm having a contraction. And she said, that's fine. Just do whatever you need. Just let me listen. You let me know if you need anything. So she sort of listened and she said, no, sweetie, like you're definitely in labor. I can tell. Come in. I'll be waiting for you here. Come and find me at the desk and we'll get you sorted and we'll get you comfortable and we can work out what you need. The car seat was so uncomfortable. Like I just could not get comfortable. I felt like her head was already out. Like I couldn't sit. The hospital called again just to check how far away I was because I didn't tell them. and I heard the obstetrician from Miller's Birth, the first one in the background. And I was like, oh, like I really wish I hadn't heard that. That really changed my whole frame of mind. And I kind of started to spiral, like my hypnobirthing wasn't working any longer. And I threw my headphones and I told my husband that I was ridiculous for thinking some deep breathing would work. And I really felt out of control and nervous and anxious. And I had for the first time dreaded what was going to happen next. Which again sounds dramatic, but just knowing my previous experience with this obstetrician, I just didn't feel confident and comfortable. And yeah, all those feelings were flooding back in. So we got to the hospital and my husband was freaking out. He like drove the wrong way around the roundabout. So I was yelling at him like, how did you not know which way to go around a roundabout? Like, what is wrong with you? Just like park at the door, let me out. And from sort of the car to the midwife station, it's about 100-meter walk, but it took me sort of 3 contractions to get there. They were just back to back at this point, but they were feeling really sort of productive. Like I could feel Ivy moving down, if that makes sense. And I sort of felt like with each contraction, we were getting closer to the end, whereas I didn't have that feeling the first time. So I walked in and the midwife, Flick, the really good one, the one that I love, was there. And she sort of took me to my room and asked me how I was. And I was like, can we just like not do the pleasantries? Can you just get me an epidural? Like, I just can't do this. I didn't think anything was going to pull me out of it.
Mm.
And she's like, you know, absolutely, I can do that. But if it's okay, can I please check your cervix first? I just don't want to make sure that you're too far along, you know, and you'll receive the epidural and it won't come in time and it won't work in time. She's like, you sound like you're pretty far along and the way you're behaving and things like that, I really don't think you have very long left. So I'd been having contractions for about 2.5 hours at this point. And she got me onto the bed and did a cervical check. And she was like, oh, I'm not really sure like what I just felt then. Can I go and get someone else just to have a second opinion if that's okay? And I was like, yeah, okay, like that's fine. And she came back in and the only other person who was available to do a cervical check was that first obstetrician. So annoyed. And I was like, why in this moment, why are you here? So I asked the midwife, I'm like, I trust you. Like, what do you think? Like, what is happening? Are you concerned about something? Are you not sure? She's like, I'm fairly sure Ivy's head is right there. Mm. Like, right there, and you don't have time for anything. Like, I know how much this feedback means to you and I want you to make a fully informed decision, and I would feel more at ease if you could get a second opinion. It's just up to you if you want to make that call. So I reluctantly said yes, and I just said, I'm like, this is all she is doing. She is here to check my cervix, tell me what she thinks, and then that is it. That is the end of her responsibility and her role in this room. So she checked my cervix and said yes, like Ivy's head is right there. You've left it too late. There is no time for an epidural. And I was like, why? Why did I wait at home so long? Like, if this is how much it's going to hurt, I regretted that decision in that moment. So they had me on the bed, which I wasn't comfortable with at all. And I wanted to be up and moving, which I think was something that I learned from my first birth. Laying down was not comfortable. And I feel that really stalled my labor. So I went and sat in on the toilet, which wasn't comfortable at all. And the first obstetrician had left at this point and the nursing unit manager came in just to see how we were going. I was really annoyed. Every time she had a question to ask me, it was in the middle of a contraction. And she was touching me and, you know, let me feel here, let me feel this, you know, do you want to do this or that? And I kept saying like, don't ask me in the middle of a contraction because I'm trying to work my way through it. I'm trying to breathe through it. I just need to focus. And she kept touching and touching. And so I said it again. And in the end, my husband stepped in and just said like, oi, she's told you very, very clearly, don't touch her. Don't do this. Don't do that. Respect her wishes or you can leave the room. So I was so grateful he stepped in at that moment. I had sort of spoken to him prior to Ivy's birth. Sorry, just to backtrack a little about everything that I wanted and how he could best support me.
That's great.
Yeah. And I feel like that was probably the most valuable thing that I did because, you know, mid contraction, when all this stuff is going on, you can't advocate for yourself because you've got so much else going on and so much else that's demanding your attention. So having him there and having him know everything that I wanted and didn't want and how I wanted to be treated and all this kind of stuff was a real big game changer for me. And I don't know, sort of next contraction things changed. And I said, like, I just need to push. My body's pushing. I just need to push. And I couldn't get comfortable on the toilet or on my hands and knees. So I hopped up on the bed again, which sort of felt most comfortable in that point. Sort of, I was sitting essentially completely upright. And each contraction came, I just said, like, I can't not push. My body's pushing. I need to push. I need to push. So I was pushing and pushing. And this was probably at about 1:05 And each time sort of the contractions were there and I was pushing, it felt like something was sort of in the way, like, it's really hard to describe. And even now thinking about it all this time, I still can't think of how best to describe it, but it felt like something was in the way. So I asked them if they could pop my waters or break my waters. And once they did that, the contractions felt so different and I could feel her moving down each contraction. It really felt like that was what was in the way. At this point, they had been checking her heart rate with a Doppler just on my stomach. And similar to Miller, her heart rate was increasing quite rapidly. It wasn't sort of going down as low as they liked. And their first obstetrician came in and expressed her concerns about that. And I said, like, it's fine. You've got a Doppler. I'm comfortable with where things are at, unless you have any like serious concerns or, you know, things like that. I don't really want to, not that I didn't want to hear what she had to say, but I just wanted to be in the zone and I just wanted to do my own thing. So at this point I had Flick, the amazing midwife, and another midwife, Anna, who was also amazing. She was in there and she was sort of my kind of person. Like, we were both kind of a bit different and we kind of just clicked right away. And she said, like, I remember you said you were going to have a VBAC and look at you, like, here you are, you're doing it kind of thing. She was a really big sort of supporter. And Ivy's heart rate at this point was climbing a little higher and higher and higher each time. And the midwife did say that it was something that she was beginning to feel a little concerned about. And that was just something that we would need to keep an eye on. And the obstetrician, the first one from Miller's birth, was in the room at this point. And I don't quite recall sort of what happened or how we got to this point, but she suggested a scalp clip for Ivy because I think they were having trouble from memory tracking her heartbeat with the Doppler. And I was not comfortable with that. That was something that they did with Miller. And I found it really deceptive the way it was described. You know, this is a clip that we just put onto Miller's head. And in my research that I did after, it's not a clip that they put onto the head. It's a screw that they screw into the baby's head. So when she mentioned that, it was like this little rage burst out. And I was like, no, like, don't you dare. You are not putting a scalp clip on my baby's head. I know what it is. I know what it actually does. And I was really annoyed at the way that it was described because it's not accurate at all. And if it had have been described properly to me in Miller's birth, I wouldn't have consented. So sort of all those feelings sort of came back when she mentioned it. The obstetrician was there at this point, sort of down the business end of things, and the contractions were coming and I was pushing and I was pushing. The heart rate wasn't getting any lower. And at this point, Anna, the midwife, who was a big supporter and who I trusted, said that she did think there would need to be some sort of intervention or something happen soon because it is getting to sort of a point where they are beginning to worry, not just the obstetrician, but the midwives in the room. And each contraction, Ivy's head wasn't looking like it was going to fit, for lack of a better term. So she suggested an episiotomy to help get Ivy's head out, which I declined. I didn't want to do that. And she said, okay, like, that's your right to decline. I'll respect that. We'll see if we can work out another way, or, you know, we're willing to work with you. This is your birth. So a few more contractions went past and the head still didn't look like it was going to fit. And I said, at this point, she's like, I know you want like a VBAC. She's like, but an episiotomy doesn't make it any less of a VBAC. She's like, I am having pretty valid concerns about her heart right now. And I didn't want one, but in the end I was just like, okay, whatever. Like, if it's just, if it's going to get you all less stressed, which is stressing me out, we'll just do it. So I did have an episiotomy. Sorry, I should just backtrack. Prior to that, sort of when all this episiotomy stuff was happening, I was looking at my husband, and this whole time he was doing exactly what I asked. Like, he was advocating for me and he was saying, like, you know, you're doing this, you're doing such a good job, I'm so proud of you. And then it came to transition, which I didn't know it was transition at the time, but I just broke down and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm not built for this. And he was like, no, like, you are doing this. Like, keep going. You're so close. You've done such an amazing job. And looking back, I know that that was obviously transition, but in that point in time, I was just like, no, I don't have anything left. Yeah, so I pushed her head out in one contraction, then her body came out the next one, and I got to reach down and grab her and pull her up onto my chest, which was so healing. It was such a healing experience. It's probably the best way to describe it. After everything that went down with Miller's birth, being able to pull her out myself and place her on my chest, there's probably nothing that will ever come close to that feeling. And I just remember yelling like, don't you dare touch the cord, leave the cord, don't touch the cord, I don't want the cord cut.
Oh, wow.
That was like the first thing in my mind, because I looked back at photos of Miller and Miller's cord was beautiful and it was blue, but it had been cut and I was really disappointed. Obviously, a lot of things happened and I got very caught up in things in Miller's birth. So yeah, she was out on my chest and I was crying and the two midwives were like, you know, you're amazing, like you've done it, this, like you should be so proud of yourself. So yeah, that environment and that sort of atmosphere, it was euphoric. Nothing compares to that, that sense of accomplishment and not like going against all odds, but having to fight for something so hard and then to get it, and to get it mostly on your own terms. And yeah, it's just nothing will ever compare to that feeling ever. It's just amazing. Oh, I still get goosebumps thinking about it.
That's so lovely. I was going to ask you, you know, when the head was kind of like close to coming out, they were sort of saying that maybe it's not going to fit.
Yes.
Were you feeling any ring of fire or anything like that at this point?
So I had started to feel like that intense burning sensation that no one ever warns you enough about. But then once we had discussed the episiotomy, they administered a local anesthetic. So the next contraction or two after that, I didn't feel that, that ring of fire, thankfully, because that's awful.
So they actually administer a local anesthetic before giving you an episiotomy. Is that standard practice? I had no idea.
I don't know, but if I could do it again, I wouldn't have the anesthetic. That local anesthetic down there was so painful. Like, I would have rathered just sort of tear naturally than experience that. That was just, so uncomfortable.
And do you feel as though if they'd given you a bit more time, it could have been possible for her head to descend more?
I feel like, and I would have wanted this, there was so much going on, it didn't enter my mind. I was quite annoyed that they didn't suggest things like, you know, why don't you turn around and hop on your knees or try squatting or, you know, change birth positions. I mean, it's not uncommon to need an episiotomy or to tear when women birth laying on their backs or, you know, laying on a hospital bed. So if I could go back in that point in time, I would have loved to have turned over onto my hands and knees or rested up against the back of the bed or something like that. Yeah. And I feel like maybe I probably wouldn't have needed an episiotomy, but I was kind of just so far down into my own little zone that it just wasn't something that I even thought of or thought to ask. But I was also kind of annoyed that it wasn't suggested as well. So after I had Ivy, she was on my chest and I said, I don't want any intervention unless it's necessary. Like, we've got this far. I would just rather you let my body do its own thing. And they waited quite a while and then I had started to bleed and quite a bit and the placenta didn't seem to be coming away. So I did agree to have the shot. And at this point I had Ivy on and she latched and she was feeding all of those.
Great.
Yeah. So I actually got to watch like the crawl that they do where they try to find the nipple, which is just amazing. So we delivered the placenta, which I don't obviously never got to experience with Miller, but that was gross. That just felt like I gave birth to like a jellyfish. No one ever tells me that either.
It's sort of like you've been through all of this and then it's another birth before.
Yeah.
Like it's, you know, the after pain, the contractions to birth the placenta and all of that.
Yeah.
Something just a real afterthought though that we don't speak about in a lot of birth preparation, or it doesn't tend to be spoken about. Like,
that's interesting.
Oh, that's right, the placenta.
Yeah, and I had sort of completely forgotten about it. Like, I was just in this euphoric state. Like, I got the VBAC that I wanted and my baby and I were safe and my husband and I were just sort of in our little love bubble. So I did end up delivering the placenta, which was sort of intact and everything like that, but I still did continue to bleed. At this point, I had declined a cannula when I was admitted because I didn't want to give them sort of an easy passage into any interventions or induction. So I declined one, but they were sort of a little concerned with how much blood I had lost, which I think ended up being around the 900 mil mark.
Is that considered postpartum hemorrhage or?
Yeah, I think anything over 500 or 600 mils is classified as a hemorrhage.
I should probably know that by now, but
I don't know.
Sure, if they classed it in your situation or in some situations.
Yeah, so they did say it was classed as a hemorrhage. The pediatrician who was on at the time sort of came in maybe an hour and a half after she was born and said, like, oh, you know, like we're going to take her now and weigh her. And the amazing midwife Anna came in and just said, no, like it's not urgent. You can go. I'll come and get you when you're ready. Like they're bonding. There's no concerns.
How are you feeling in terms of your recovery sort of from the episiotomy? Was that feeling quite sore by this stage or?
Yeah, that was really sore and I didn't anticipate how painful that would be. I couldn't sit properly on anything for maybe 2 weeks. And if I did sit sort of on the couch, I had to sort of sit leaning to one side. I couldn't just sit normally. Standing for long periods of time was really painful. Like the best way I can describe it is it felt like there was like a bowling ball like attached like every time I would stand. And sometimes like standing for 15, 20 minutes was too much. And then I had to sit back down again. Like it was just so painful.
And how did it end up healing sort of after that initial period? Was it a really long process?
I had concerns around sort of the 1 week post-birth mark where it looked like the stitches from the obstetrician from Miller's birth hadn't been done properly. It was sort of neat and then there was like a section that wasn't healing or closing over. The midwife that came out to the home said, you know, we kind of don't really redo these things unless there's a major need for it. We'll just monitor it and see how you go. So it probably stopped hurting altogether maybe 3 or 4 weeks post her birth. But yeah, it's not something I would do again if I had the choice.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, if we can avoid it. In terms of breastfeeding with Ivy, how was that going and how did that compare to your first experience?
That was so different. They probably couldn't be more polar opposite experiences if you tried. Learning sort of what I did from Miller's experience and my journey feeding her, maybe within 12 hours of Ivy being born, I had already started to experience like the sore and cracked nipples. So I made sure to ask for help. The midwife, Anna, she sat with me and said, you know, each time you have a feed, buzz me, or each time you think you need to feed her, buzz me. I'll come in, I'll help you assess how she's latching. I'll teach you how to make sure she's latched on properly, which was such a game changer. Like the difference between an incorrect latch and a correct latch is huge. And that definitely made such a difference in my feeding journey. And even just things like she provided advice, like, you know, if you think she's hungry, you know, just feed her. You don't need to wait 3 hours. You know, if she's hungry, feed her. You don't eat every 3 hours. And just like really good advice, like if in doubt, put her on. Like, you know, if you've tried everything else and nothing has worked, just put her on. Yeah. And I think that really set us up for success. So she was exclusively breastfed till 6 months, which is when we introduced like those high allergen foods and things, just given our experience with Mila. And she's still feeding now. So only once, at night, she still needs milk to go to sleep at night. But yeah, so completely different experiences. And I think it all just stems back to that information and support that I was given in those first sort of 12 to 24 hours post-birth. Like that made such a difference to me. And now we've been able to go on sort of almost two and a half years.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And in terms of you've spoken a little bit about that, obviously you felt you had that support from the hospital. You had the same model of care, so both in the public hospital and in terms of that with an obstetrician overseeing the midwives. So what did you think was different this time around in this pregnancy and birth as opposed to the first time there?
I think part of it was the support from those midwives in the beginning, you know, that said, you know, you can do this and we're here for you. We work ultimately for you and we'll support you and do whatever you need. I think that was a big thing. But I also think just that research and that education that I did for myself, like knowledge is power. And sometimes you don't get all the knowledge and information presented to you. And that's not right. And that's not the way that it should be. But I really believe that all that research and education that I did is what led to a successful VBAC, and just trusting my body and understanding that my body already has like this perfect mix of hormones and chemicals that I don't need to introduce all these external things. I just need to trust my body and trust the process, and like this is what my body was built for, and it can do it if it's just left to its own. So yeah, definitely the research, I think, and the educating and empowering myself.
Have you given much thought to, oh, if you don't mind me asking, sort of subsequent pregnancies then, and anything, you know, you might take from these first two birth experiences, anything else that you would do differently?
Yep. So I definitely still would attempt a VBAC, or have a VBAC. Sorry, I will have a VBAC.
Yes. You'll do it.
Yeah, that's it. I suppose to me, just I would probably pay and invest in a proper hypnobirthing course next time. I feel like it's really valuable. I probably just didn't educate myself or practice enough to get the full benefit of it. I would ultimately love to have a water birth next time. Like, that would be my dream. I've always loved water. I've always been around water, and it's always been really sort of soothing and calming and just a place where I can go to collect myself. So I really envisage that being a part of my next birth. And probably just the importance of moving or changing positions to avoid that episiotomy next time. I really think if I had have had that suggested or had have tried that, then that's probably something that would have helped me to avoid an episiotomy.
How is your, I guess now, like the effects of the episiotomy, has that all completely healed and everything's now okay, like 2 years down the track? Or
So externally it's all healed. I've done like a little bit of research, and from what I understand, sometimes you need external and internal stitches. I haven't really delved in too far because I kind of don't want to know. But I do think that there was an issue with some of my stitches, and it doesn't look like things internally were fixed or stitched as they probably should. Sorry, too much information maybe there.
No, that's okay.
But yeah, which is kind of annoying. I always knew that OB would come back to haunt me one way or another, and it was ultimately her who did the stitches, so I'm really annoyed. I know it's something so minor and superficial, but yeah, I just say so externally everything is healed fine, and I don't honestly even feel like I've had an episiotomy now, so I'm really grateful for that. I know some women aren't that lucky and sort of have effects and side effects that go on for years post-birth. So
Oh, any advice that you would give other women, particularly actually in terms of women who have experienced a Bandel's ring in their labours or births, anything that you would advise them?
I probably just not to get, I suppose, too much caught up in the whole Bandel ring thing. Like, obviously, yes, it happened, and it doesn't define you or your baby, and it doesn't define how future pregnancies will go. And I think that's what I learned most from mine is, but ultimately I would say just to trust your body and your baby. Like, they know what they're doing. Women have been birthing for how long? Birth itself has become so sort of over medicalized, or, and I'm not sure if that's just a Western culture type thing, but yeah, just to trust your body and your baby. Like, they know what they're doing, and you already have everything that you need to have a successful birth. And that's not to say that C-sections aren't necessary, because I know that they have their place and that they do save lives. But yeah, just trust your body and your baby, and ask questions. Ask questions, because if you don't ask, then you don't know. And yeah, knowledge is power, really is.
Yeah, 100%. Definitely great advice.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for sharing with us. And it was great to hear your perspective on things, and a different perspective.
Just so nice to finally chat to you
as well. Yeah, I know, because you were one of the earlier people.
But it's such an important story, because I don't know anyone. Like, I had no idea that you could have a VBAC after a Bandel's ring. So thank you for coming on and sharing your story and providing some inspiration for mums who have been in your situation. Yeah.
Thank you for having me on. I hope people find value or can even just relate.
Definitely. It's
something that a lot of people do is attempt a VBAC. So take from it what you will, and Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's been so lovely to chat with you guys.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC story. If you like the show, please subscribe and feel free to leave a review. If you would like to connect with us on social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VBAC Birth Stories. If you have a question or you'd like to express interest in sharing your personal story, email us at vbacbirthstories@gmail.com. VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.